So I think my presentation follows on nicely from Bogdan's, which was concentrated on constitution making. That is an element of what I'm about to say. The topic is successful constitutions. Now, that's a very unclear and in some ways provocative, what is a successful constitution? I'm here to try to explain what I mean by successful constitution. And just a little bit of background. So if you look around the place, a lot of constitutional systems seem to be under threat. Now, maybe that's always the case, and we just know more about them now, but certainly that is the case. Some are collapsing. Ukraine, we've heard about, well, is it collapsing? Afghanistan, Iran, Thailand, Venezuela. I mean, the list can go on. It's a very long list. Others are under strain, Belgium, Egypt, and again, the list could go on. Some, on the other hand, remain rock solid. That's USA, Canada, Germany, UK, dare I say, rock solid. We've just gone through a potential breakup of the Union, but it was weathered with, I think, considerable tolerance on the one hand, but also a certain resilience on the other hand. So it's hard not to ask the question, well, why do some succeed? Why do others fail? And it seems to me this is not a question that is often asked. So, for example, as in the last session, when this was the point of my question in a way, or my comment, that, well, when we talk about constitution making, what is the purpose of constitution making? It's not just to produce a nice text, of course not. It has to be something much more fundamental than that. So one answer would be, the object, the purpose is to make a constitution that works. That is, that's what I mean by successful. Of course, I'll try to unravel that a bit more. Most concern, it seems to me, in the scholarship is not with the question of why do some succeed. It's a question more of looking at the text and seeing whether the text measures up to international standards. Iraq has a beautiful constitution. According to international standards, it bears very little relationship with the social realities in Iraq, and one could multiply that example many times. So the question here is, can we build up a picture of a successful constitution? And I want to just address four questions. First, what does success mean? Secondly, what are the conditions of success? Thirdly, what are the mechanisms of success? And fourthly, what is the content of success? Now, I don't pretend that I'll answer all those questions in 20 minutes or so, but I just want to sketch out, a bit in the way Daniel and Bogdan have, sketch out a kind of map in a way which would open itself to more extensive inquiry. Now, I want to start with David Hume. Now, this may seem a long way from contemporary constitutional concerns, but I find Hume addresses this question in a very direct way. David Hume, the Scottish historian, philosopher, will be known to most of you, perhaps not to everybody. I start with Hume because Hume was one of the few to ask a question about successful constitutions. Hume's most important modern exponent, I think, is Russell Hardin of New York University, who has an essay in this volume that I've edited with Mila Versteeg on, and I think I'd certainly recommend Russell Hardin's work. I think he's an extremely able and perceptive, not just exponent, but also I think he's taken Hume much further. According to Hume, there are two conditions of a successful constitution. And I use the word success without defining it. I hope the sense will emerge. There are two conditions. One is an effective system of government, and the other is acquiescence of the people. Constitutions, on this view, are coordination devices. That is, they coordinate social and political life, which is to say, they provide an authoritative basis for the conduct of social and political life, or at least large parts of it. So on the Hume-Hardin approach, establishing a constitution, making a constitution, is a massive act of coordination. Just think about it. Maybe I could just quote briefly from something that Hardin has written on this point. Russell Hardin says that establishing a constitution is itself a massive act of coordination, which, if it is stable for a while, creates a convention that depends for its maintenance on its self-generating incentives and expectations. So what he says there, in a way, just notice this word, that a constitution is not, a constitution is a self-enforcing device. Nobody can really enforce the constitution, not for an extended period. So there has to be some way of understanding successful constitutions as self-enforcing. Now notice also here the mention of a convention, and this is really crucial to the analysis. There's a double convention in effect. One convention is a convention amongst officials, and the convention is to govern according to the constitutional text and any other assumptions implicit in the text. There's also a second convention which applies amongst the people. That is, that the population acquiesces according to a second convention. That is to say, once established, once a constitution is established, at least in a sort of tentative way, a convention comes into effect that the people accept that that's the way things are done. That's all, as simple as that's the way things are done here. So government then is empowered by those two conventions, and it has the power to do many things. Both conventions are necessary for a successful coordination. So that's the Humean Hardened structure. Now there are problems, in my view, with that structure. First of all, take the convention amongst officials, that they will govern according to the constitution. Well, this is not as straightforward as it sounds at first sight. Why should officials govern according to the constitution? Or in other words, why should a convention grow up? Why should a convention be established according to which officials accept that they must govern according to that set of rules? Now notice there's an ambiguity about coordination here. There are all sorts of coordination devices floating around. The constitution is just one of them. So the question that we have to ask is, why do officials accept this coordination device, bearing in mind that officials are acting according to a convention, they're not under force, why would they adopt this coordination device and govern according to this coordination device? Because often this coordination device will be very inconvenient. Just as we heard this morning, the Ukrainian constitution turns out to be rather inconvenient for the president of the Ukraine. And so he doesn't govern according to this device. So the question that I don't think Hume and Harding really address is why officials accept this constitutional device, given the limitations it places on their powers. What they give us, I think, is the conclusion that there is a convention. They don't tell us how that convention comes about or what are the ingredients for that convention. Okay, so we need, therefore, to broaden out our analysis. First of all, let's just look at the nature of constitutions themselves a bit more. And we have to ask, what is the point or purpose or function of a constitution? Again, back to Bentham, what's the mischief that constitutions are aimed to remove? Now, the standard answer is that constitutions create government, they allocate powers to institutions, and they regulate relations between people and government. But that's actually, although as orthodox and conventional as that is, it's rather unsatisfactory because it's inadequate. There's something more fundamental at stake here, I think. Something more deep in the foundations of society. And that, I think, is the expression of relations between the people and government. Those other features of constitutions follow from some sort of special relationship between the people and those that govern the people. And just a couple more, to embellish that a little bit more. So the very idea of a constitution is to limit the powers of government. I mean, that seems to me is fundamental to a constitution. Otherwise, what's the point of a constitution? If it doesn't limit the powers of government, what's its point? If it doesn't limit the powers of government, it means government can do what it likes, subject to all sorts of political and economic and social constraints, but not subject to constitutional constraints. Secondly, I would say that a requirement of the government-people relations is implicit. Sorry, in that relationship between government and people, there is an implicit set of values. Whatever they may be, there's some implicit set of values. Otherwise, again, you might say, what's the point? Why limit government unless there's some important values at stake? So, what I think is at issue here is the very idea of a constitution, not as just a mechanism for creating institutions of government and telling them what powers they've got, but rather a much more socially founded, socially grounded idea, somehow emerging out of the very body politic, the very idea of a society, of social organizations. You know, in the early constitutional writings in Europe, they used to talk a lot about the body politic in a way analogous to the body, the real body. Because and this is a puzzling metaphor in a way. So they talk about, you know, the body politic as in bad health. We need the doctor, the physician to come in and restore the body politic to good health. Now, at one level, this is kind of odd to the modern mind to talk in this way. If you try to understand what the point of this talk was, it is quite revealing, I think. And what I would say is, and I need much longer to develop this thesis, what I'd say is that behind this is a very fundamental notion of society. That nothing more than that, if you're going to have a society, you have to have something, some cement, something that will hold it together in the most fundamental way. There's a whole literature on that, you know, from Thomas Hobbes to John Locke and so on. What is that initial cement? Why do people enter into a society rather than stay in what Hobbes calls the state of nature? And this, I think, is what takes us really to the fundamental idea. And this, I think, is what's missing in Hume. And I could give you various quotations, but just a couple more points. I'm not talking about a contract here or a convention. This is another device to try to capture this sense of the foundations of society. Very popular, particularly in the 18th and 19th century, the idea of a contract. You know, Hobbes comes up, says there's a convention. You know, this is an elusive, I mean, these don't work. These just don't work. But you can see what they're trying to get at. They're trying to find some fundamental relationship that will help to explain and make sense of a constitution. They don't succeed, but I think they don't succeed because it's not a contract. What they're looking for is some origin. Now, the origins of constitutions are very interesting. Essentially, constitutions emerged to protect private property, I would argue. Constitutions are essentially come out of private property, and you can add personal rights if you like, but personal rights, property rights. Adam Smith sums it up, and he says, look, if we're all shepherds and we start to have our own flocks, we can't spend 24 hours a day looking after our sheep. We need someone to come and look after them for us, or at least to keep off the sheep rustlers. Origins of a constitution, nothing more fundamental. It's that private relations need to have some way of securing certain fundamental social goods, protection of rights, protection of person, general security. You could add, if you like, keeping of promises, which is another fundamental. You see, there's a whole literature, again, attempting to get to the bottom of this fundamental social relationship out of which constitutions naturally emerge. I think Adam Smith does it pretty well. Very mundane, but I think he does it pretty well. John Locke is very similar. Locke puts it in terms of directly of property rights, but I prefer Adam Smith. I think it's even more fundamental. So, let's move on therefore from that. I'm not suggesting that I have now pinned down completely that relationship, but it's somehow there, you know, it's somehow that idea of a fundamental private social relations come prior to constitutions. Constitutions emerge out of prior social relationships. That's the sort of basic idea. So we need to look, therefore, at that second convention. We need to look at that more closely, that second convention of popular compliance, acquiescence. I love the word acquiescence, you know, it resonates for me. Some people hate it. You can talk about compliance, you can talk about acceptance, tacit acceptance, all sorts of words, which, but acquiescence is a useful word because it means essentially tacit acceptance. It doesn't mean a positive consent. You see, consent theories, again, are very common in early constitutional writing. The people must consent. That's Daniel and Ribby would use the word legitimating device. I try to avoid legitimation. It's on my list of banned words. But anyhow, you know the idea. So, but consent is not, you know, there's no consent here. Okay, so I want to just explore a little bit more this idea of popular acquiescence. So the suggestion I want to put to you is, A, that constitutions are self-enforcing. So we need to find the cement. We need to find the mechanisms, if you like. We need to ask what incentives people have to accept any system of effective coordination. What are those incentives? Now, Hume and Harden will put those incentives simply in very pragmatic, factual terms. For example, once the system is in operation, it's pretty impossible to change it. You, an individual, you have to accept that convention because everybody else has accepted it. And it's a massive coordination moment to get enough people together to resist. Now, of course, it happens from time to time. But the question Hume was like, why doesn't it happen more? You know, Hume says something like, anyone of a philosophical mind will wonder, why on earth do the people who hold the natural liberty and natural power, why on earth do they hand over that natural liberty to a few people who can then tell them what to do? So Harden then tries to provide an answer to that by saying, look, once that convention is in place, it's very hard to resist. But that doesn't get us to the core of the problem. We still need to know how that convention gets into place. So here I would, again, and I'm just mapping rather than explaining in a detail, here I would turn to another body of literature, another way of thinking about these things, and that is to look at the attitudes, the understandings, the expectations of the people. And I'm using people in the loosest, broadest possible sense. Nothing technical about this. People have a sense of their world. They make sense of their world. They make it understandable. And there's a wonderful book called Weapons of the Weak, which is an anthropological study of tenant farmers in Indonesia. It seems a long way from, well, perhaps not to Rina and Kathy, but it's a long way from here. The point about that book is that it shows that even in very constrained and impoverished circumstances, that is, of very poor tenant farmers, they have a world, they have a moral world, a kind of constitutional world of their own. Some of the literature even extends this idea into slavery, even amongst slaves, and there are wonderful studies of American slavery, or slavery in America. Where again, even in these very subservient, subjugated conditions, the slaves have a moral world. E.P. Thompson, a very famous historian here in England, referred to the moral economy of the crown. This is a wonderful expression. But what he was trying to get at was to understand what it is that animates the people. What are the understandings, the normative expectations that the people have? Now, Thompson's point was, we don't know much about the people because they weren't the ones who generally wrote books, they weren't the ones who wrote theses about treatises. The writers of such things were usually from much better, highly educated, aristocratic, semi-aristocratic classes. So but without distinguishing between them too much, what I'm just saying is that even at the lowest levels of society, slaves, tenant farmers, the ordinary people, peasants rebelling there in 1381, you know, up in north of England, the peasant revolt. They all, if you look at them closely, they have a whole way of understanding their world, a set of what I would call cognitive and normative expectations and understandings. All right. So here one would call in aid, particularly, I think, the Max Weber, the Weberian approach here. because Weber emphasized that if you want to understand the social world, look at the meanings people give to their actions. Explore those meanings, and through those meanings you will understand how people think, and not just think, that's too simple, but their whole way of understanding their world. And Weber's argument is that the way we understand our world is the basis on which we normally act. So there's a causal thesis hidden in there as well. Now, that, I don't want to go into that, but that's, I think that generally holds up. The way we interpret and understand our world is usually the way we act. We act in accordance with those meanings. So, back to coordination. We now have coordination theory, but we have some substance in that second convention, that convention of acquiescence. We're now starting to, I think, to give that some substance. The people will insert into that, will build a convention, not just around the fact that there's effective government, but they will build a convention around those ingredients which somehow reflect their fundamental expectations and understanding. Now, we can talk about that a bit more. Let me move on. So I've answered the first two questions, I hope, in a very mapping kind of way. Now I'm going to try to just very briefly talk about the third of those questions, the mechanisms of success. So on my score, of course you may not agree with me, I've told you what success means, and I've told you the conditions of success. Of course it has to be filled out, but I've given you a landscape. The mechanisms of success is my third. So and here I want to just pick up on what Bogdan said. I'll leave out the rest. Just pick up on what Bogdan said. And the key mechanism, you might think, is how a constitution is made. And there's a lot of emphasis on constitution making now in the literature and in the research. And if you look at this this book of essays that I edited with a former student of mine, Social and Political Foundation of Constitution, a lot of essays in there, very good case studies of constitution making, empirical studies. Now, it remains something of a puzzle, though. Well, let me put it this way. The argument would be that the way a constitution is made is the process that leads to a successful constitution. So this was the point I raised before. So here the argument is that depending on how the constitution is made will depend on whether you get a successful outcome, that is to say, a successful constitution. A lot of emphasis is put on, as Bogdan brought out, on various mechanisms. I just pick up on participation of the people. You mentioned Iceland at length, Bogdan. Consultation, participation, hearing the voices. The trouble with this is there simply is no empirical evidence, one way or the other. France, Fifth Republic, very successful constitution. No popular participation whatsoever. You know, this was made by General Charles de Gaulle, and he wasn't interested in what the people thought. Japan, Rina will be familiar with that. A wonderful essay in here on the making of the Japanese constitution, and it's much more than an imposed constitution, by the way. Certainly it was created under the general control of General MacArthur and his advisors, but what David Law brings out in his essay is that the Japanese people, interestingly, were in a way able to have some very indirect but important influence on that constitution. So that, how does that cut? On the other hand, I discovered recently in Japan for how deeply embedded this constitution has become in the Japanese consciousness. A bit of controversy over one or two clauses, but basically, so here we have what many would think of as an imposed constitution. Even, as you mentioned, the German constitution. This was a constitution made under the watchful eye of the Allies. So I just wanted to say a little bit more, though, about constitution making. You see, so what are the effects, the possible effects? I've already dealt with participation. I don't think participation in itself is kind of helps you one way or the other. Does participation have any effect on the outcome? The outcome being a successful constitution. I'm not just talking about text. I'm talking about a text that is successful. So there may be some direct outcomes of participation that are rather important. One would be that participation brings to light problems, brings to light issues which would not otherwise be noticed. So it's not as if that participation itself is the virtue. The virtue is that participation is a mechanism that might reveal issues that would be wisely considered in the constitution debate. They may be issues of ethnic division, for example. There might be issues of past wrongs. I think you can build up from participation a set of, that's just one example, but you can build up others. The way in which participation, consultation, may have outcome effects that are relevant to a successful constitution. Some would argue that, of course, another argument, namely that the very act of participating in some way induces a higher level of acquiescence or a stronger acquiescence. This is a very bad argument. This is a really bad argument. There's not one shred of evidence for this. Constitutions in which people have participated highly are not necessarily successful or unsuccessful. People have no stronger sense of commitment. And anyhow, think about it. How many generations ago did Scott's ancestors consent to the American Constitution? He didn't. So I think this is a really poor argument. Poor in the sense it's completely lacking empirical evidence. So the mere fact of participation, I don't think, leads you anywhere in terms of acquiescence. There's another sense, I think, in which participation or involvement might have an important outcome effect. Namely, and this again is elusive, but it may be not just that my voice gets heard and somehow reflected and bogged and dealt with that. The more voices you have, the more confusing it becomes, frankly. But there's another sense that I'm searching for here. Maybe you can... There's a sense in which involvement in the process reinforces this as a constitution, that is, as a way of doing business. Now, I know that's a bit vague, but there's something about being involved in the process makes it somehow a constitution that makes it a real constitution, regardless, in a sense, of what the substance is. And this I refer back to that basic idea of the body politic, that somehow the body politic is made whole, is given integrity. Maybe integrity is not a bad word. The body politic is given a certain integrity if there's been wide consultation or extensive participation, the voices have been heard. So you see, it's a subtle argument, but there may be something in that. We need empirical, I know of no empirical evidence on that, but it goes back to that idea of a fundamental constitution. David Hume again spoke in trying to identify the mechanisms. He said, look, one of the conditions of a successful coordination device is that you provide a system of justice. It's interesting, that isn't it? In the 18th century, this was always being put forward as central to a constitution system, that in a well-functioning body politic, a system of justice is an essential part, an essential feature. So here again, you see, this can be tested, that we take it for granted that a constitution must have a system of justice. Goes back, if you like, to that very early Adam Smith kind of approach. A system of justice is necessary for the protection of rights, the protection of property. And you can go back to Roman law, if you like, and you'll find that... And talking of Roman law brings me to another potential requirement of a successful constitution. Maybe this is even more substantive than a mechanism, but juridical equality, I mentioned. Juridical equality. Now, I studied rebellion. I studied a lot of rebellion. It's a very fascinating social activity. Why do people rebel, given all the odds against successful rebellion? And particularly in constitution history, rebels were dealt with extremely severely. So the rebel took a huge risk. But English history is littered with rebellions, most highly unsuccessful. But why do people rebel? You know, in looking at the literature on rebellion, the one constant factor that I have found in looking at a lot of social history is the claim for what I would call juridical equality. Not material or social equality, but juridical equality. That is some recognition of me, the rebel, as a right holder. Go back to the foundations of the Constitution. It comes out, if you like, of right-duty relationships. And again, that needs to be explored further. That idea comes from Vico. That was Vico. I wanted to test Vico's idea by looking at rebellion, and I find it rings true. Of course, other mechanisms are certain kinds of institutions in addition to a system of justice, but I won't try to go into those. I'll conclude then by my fourth question, that is the content of a successful constitution. Now, critics of the coordination approach say, look, it offers no guidance as to content. That's the problem. So Ginsburg and people of that ilk, they argue, look, this is coordination theory. It's misconceived because it tells you nothing about the content of constitutions. So you have some arguing that power relations tell you about the content, Rand Herschel. You have others like, well, Ginsburg himself thinks a contract frame tells you about the content. Well, they may tell you something about the contract, of course. There are many ways of about the Constitution. There are many ways of approaching it. But again, I wonder whether there is something, whether we can be just, again, map a little bit more directly what some of the content of a constitution need to be. I've already given you an idea. You know, property, person, security, those basic things. You know, Machiavelli, much discredited, poor old Niccolo. But we had his 500th anniversary of the Prince recently. I just want to... This is from the discourse, it's not from the prince. In a page in this again, a little quote. You know, Machiavelli said, people are not all that demanding. Most people don't want to govern, let alone be self-governing, you know. That's, most people don't even want to be sort of too involved. He said, it is a ring home to you, in a kind of Adam Smith bucolic kind of way. He said, the people desire to be free. Why? In order to live securely. They want to be able to possess one's things freely, without any suspicion, not fearing for oneself. Men of such a humour, when they are governed well, neither seek nor want any other freedom. You know, that seems to me, again, hits on a very fundamental nerve in the content of constitutions. And again, I find it consistent with that general idea that constitutions in their origins, the foundation of the body politic, are the protection and the provision of certain very fundamental social goods. Now, our expectations now are higher, of course. We're no longer content with property, basic human security. We want all sorts of fancy rights over human rights, loosely speaking, but all sorts of services and provisions of a positive kind. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's useful as well, I think, to go back to the origins. And just, I mentioned a couple of others, remedy of past wrongs, fundamental idea in the social understanding of the content of constitutions. On the other hand, the document must somehow meet future expectations. Think of any constitution-making situation, there are some expectations about the future. And that's again where the constitution-making process may help you to know what those expectations are. I don't actually care very much who makes the constitution, as long as they know what they're doing. The trouble is most constitution makers have no idea what they're doing. So that's why they think all this popular participation or keep the, whatever it is. Hey, what are the future expectations? Again, come back to post-war Japan. What was interesting there, that the people, lots of civil society groups there, after the horrors of the war and so on, they really had a different vision of the future from the nationalist, rather militaristic government that had been in power for some years. And this was what MacArthur found so important, that he was able to tap into those, understand the expectation of the Japanese people. And to my mind, he's been proved right. He was accurate in predicting those expectations. Well, then there are other obvious things, such as dealing with social divisions of an ethnic, religious kind, and people have touched on those. Interestingly, Poland is perhaps not a bad example. Someone mentioned earlier today that Ukraine was slow to adopt a constitution. Well, that was thought to be a bad thing. Poland was just as slow to adopt a constitution. Is that a bad thing? Polish constitution seems very successful. Why did Poland delay? Because the relations between church and Catholic church and state had to be resolved. Had Poland rushed into a constitution in 1990, say, instead of 1995-96, it might have well not dealt properly with that problem. It hadn't been worked out in that immediate post-Soviet period. It wasn't clear. By 1995-6, it seemed to have been resolved, and as far as I can tell, it's a well-working constitution. That issue is no longer divisive. So, that's a kind of sketch of what I understand by successful constitution. I've tried to answer those four different questions in a very impressionistic way. But I'm happy for your comments.